Hello and welcome to Bombshells. I'm Fleur Elizabeth.
And I'm Amy Shepherd.
And today we are joined by another Amy, Amy Gallagher.
Hello. So, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you on. 1 week away from the London mayoral elections, yeah. So it must be getting a bit exciting, a bit scary.
Yeah, it's exciting. I'll be glad when it's over. It's been a bit stressful, but it's been good. I've learned a lot. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the declaration and then seeing what happens.
Yeah.
It's very good.
And also juggling that with practicing as a nurse,
yeah.
And the court case that you have going on with Tavistock.
I've got a lot going on.
Having followed that case, it's absolutely unbelievable, some of the stuff that they were saying. I mean, some of it I would literally gasp whilst reading it. But for those who don't know about the case, could you just briefly explain?
Yeah, so as you said, I'm a nurse, a mental health nurse, and I've trained to be a psychotherapist at the Tavistock. I'd already done 2 years there. I was close to qualifying. And essentially, they were pushing critical race theory in quite an aggressive way. So they initially sent a lecture round called Whiteness, a Problem for Our Time. And in it, they were just making overtly racist statements about white people. White privilege is a reality, white people don't understand the world, white people this, white people that. And it was presented as though it was the truth. Like, it wasn't like there is this thing called critical race theory and it says this, but this is the, you know, this is the positives of it, this is the downsides of it. It was just like, this is the truth. And it was the most hysterical thing I'd ever seen. So I responded to it and said, well, you know, not everybody thinks this way. And if we're treating patients in the NHS, we need to know that not everybody thinks this way. And then what ensued from that was about 2 years of like harassment and bullying and trying to hound me off their course. They kept sending me all of the Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility is like, she's like their god at the Tavistock. She's like the authority on race, even though she's not, none of our ideas are evidence-based. She's not a psychotherapist. She's just like a race huckster. And they were very anti-Christian as well, saying Christianity's, I'm a Christian, and they were saying Christianity's racist because it's European. And they were sending around more and more reading material that was pushing these ideas, and I was asked how I felt about them, and I said, well, it's not evidence-based, it's racist for this reason. And then they said, so they raised a student conduct policy against me. They wrote a letter to me saying that I spoke inappropriately about race. All I'd ever said was that essentially I subscribe to the colorblind approach, which is not judging a person by the color of their skin. They said that was discredited and outdated, and we now take the critical race theory approach. And then it was just more and more. Eventually, I was told I was unsafe. I was traumatizing people. I shouldn't be allowed into certain parts of the building. And then my clinical work with patients was eventually stopped, even though I was doing really good work with patients and they were even saying that themselves. So, I'm in the process of litigating against them for victimization and discrimination. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It was like a nightmare. It's like a Kafkaesque nightmare.
Yes.
I was just, some of the stuff was unbelievable. I think when you said, there was one thing where they said that because you're white, you need to acknowledge that you have power over your patients.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's just unbelievable.
So I wrote a complaint about what they were saying, and I said, this is racist. This is the definition of racism, making a negative generalisation about a race. Here's the negative generalisations you've made about white people, so you're being racist. And they did an investigation, and in their investigation report, essentially they doubled down and they said that we've realised we need to make whiteness a part of our policies going forward, and that whiteness as a system of power and privilege needs to be taught more, not less, and we need to encourage all students to interrogate their whiteness. They put that to me in writing. And I was like, what does that... And when you question them, when you say, what does that mean to interrogate my whiteness? What do you want me to do? They don't know. They just like go away and think about it and like, what then? And it's like, it's just the madness.
Yeah, it's like pseudo-academic rubbish.
Yeah.
That they'll say so many words without really saying anything.
Exactly.
And but you were training as a nurse.
Yeah.
What's anything to do with this got to do with nurse?
This is what, yeah, was, yeah, I was trained to be a psychotherapist. I was a nurse and I was trained to be a psychotherapist. Yeah. But this is coming through in nursing as well. I'm seeing it in my nursing. But you're right. And that's another point I was saying, like, this is not what I was trained to be. I'm training to be a clinician in the NHS. Like, you're entitled to your private views as lecturers. But what has this got to do with psychotherapy? And they, when you push them, they then just say you're attacking them because they don't have an answer. So they just then say you're talking inappropriately, like you need to stop. And it's like, no, I'm a student. I'm asking for clarity on the ideas you're teaching. That's what a student should do. A student should seek to understand what it is you're teaching. But they say asking questions is an attack. So it's like mm-hmm. a complete shutdown. It's like a struggle session where you've got to accept what they say, and that's that. Mm. And it's like, it was like a nightmare. It was just unbelievable. I still sort of can't believe it in some ways. But
saying that you have power over your patients if they're of another race is not only racist to you as a white person,
exactly.
but them to say that they are like these weak, feeble people, which they're not. You know, as you said, you have a colorblind approach. And why would you treat somebody differently? Why would they say that all nurses will treat people differently but if they're a different skin colour?
Well, this is the thing, because if you're treating somebody who's of a different race to you, my approach would be to just totally keep a complete open mind. I don't know what's going on in their head. I don't know what they think or feel about anything. But to come in straight away and think, well, they must feel threatened by me because I'm white, I'm making an assumption already. Mm. I don't know how they think or feel. They might think they're better than me. I don't know. You know, until you ask someone, you don't know.
Exactly.
But they're telling you that actually you know what's going on in a person's head based on their skin colour.
It's an interesting admission from them, really, because it seems like an admission of their subconscious that they actually do think they're better in some kind of way. But
they're saying we are the privileged race.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, okay, really?
Did anyone else, any other nurses, feel uncomfortable about this? Or do you think maybe they did, but they kept silent?
Nobody on the course overtly said anything. Like, since I've been in the media and talking about these issues, I've had people contact me privately. People who were on, like, one of the courses that was running alongside this course said, oh, you know, I was in a seminar with you and I was, you know, I was appalled as well by what was happening. I've had nurses contact me and said, you know, we're being taught about racism more and more, and it's like, I'm training to be a nurse. Yes, why am I being taught this? You know, one of the lecturers actually attempted to kind of have me struck off as a nurse, essentially. So they wrote to the Nursing Midwifery Council and said that I was ignorant about slavery and therefore I shouldn't be able to work as a nurse. And it's like, they're never going to ask me about slavery. But also, like, in nursing, you're not taught about slavery.
No.
It's not a part of the nursing curriculum. Like, I don't need to know about
everything that you're describing here reinforces everything I think we think about the diversity, equity and inclusion education system in our institutions. Because when it's delivered to you, and if you've ever encountered it, you do just think, if I say anything remotely nuanced against this, and when they ask you, like, do you have a difference of opinion or something, you know you can't actually say the truth, like what you really think.
It's like double think. Like, they were kept saying, we need to have more and more conversations about racism. We need to talk openly about racism. We need to have anti-racist conversations. And I was like, okay, well, you're saying things that are racist, so I'm going to do what you're telling me to do. I'm going to, you know, stand up to racism. And then when you do that, they're like, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to speak. And it's like, but you've just told me we need to have conversations about racism and you're being racist. So it's just like this, it's just totally, like, it's completely maddening. It's like, they're saying the complete opposite and it's crazy.
But they're so powerful. Have this power that they can really interrupt, disrupt and destroy your career.
Yeah.
If you say anything, or if you show them that you are a kind of disruptor to the narrative, they will go after you like they've done to you. So I don't understand where their power comes from.
Well, it's interesting because they see themselves as like critiquing power.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're trying to identify the oppressors, and they're all about sort of bringing people down in positions of power. But they're actually just describing what they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they are the authoritarians. They are the one that are abusing their positions of power to, like, you know, interrogate and you bully people who are lower down than them. I think that's why they're so attracted to this ideology, because they have an obsession with power. They see power everywhere. Mm. Like, most of us don't. Most of us just want to, like, connect with people and enjoy our lives.
Yeah.
We're not, like, looking for oppressors everywhere. But that's them. So that's why they see it everywhere. But they can't. It was remarkable because these are supposed to be people who are like psychologically minded, and they have no kind of self-reflection.
And you had quite a lot of personal attacks.
Yeah.
Into your character.
Yeah.
And I'm just gonna say, I've never met anyone quite as just kind of neutral as a person as you. You're very smiley. I can't imagine you saying anything in a rude tone.
No, they kept saying, eventually, because they kept saying, oh, you're talking inappropriate about race. And I kept saying, what have I said that's inappropriate? And then eventually they backtracked because they couldn't quote anything. So they said, oh, it's your tone. Your tone was inappropriate. It's like, can you be specific about that? Because if you're criticizing my tone, then I need to change my tone. And going forward, I need to know. And they couldn't, it's just like, oh, your manner. It's like, but what is that? And they don't have anything. It's like, yeah, you've got nothing, have you?
Good on you for backing them into a corner.
having gone through all of that and this court case, looking back, do you think it was worth the hassle speaking up?
It's been very, very stressful. It's brought lots of positives because I've met so many people, like the guy I'm with now I met through this case. I've met amazing people. I feel very proud of it. I've had lots of people contact me saying thank you so much. I'm just proud to have done something I believe in. But I would say it's incredibly difficult to go through a legal case. I didn't even know how. Difficult it would be, how long it would be. I didn't realize how long it would be and just how stressful it is. But people are having to do this more and more, and it's why it's something I feel passionate about, because I don't think good people who are just trying to enter a profession should have to do this. And it's as we've seen, more and more people are going through this. I know you've had experiences yourself of sort of cancellation, and it just needs to stop.
Yeah, what got me through mine, which you've said the same as you, is your faith. But unfortunately, I don't know what denomination you are, but the Church of England's just as bad.
Oh, I know.
I mentioned in our last episode that there's a vicar who said that she's been to a conference about anti-whiteness. I complained to her diocese, and they wrote back and said, I said, as a white person, am I like welcome to come to services in the Liverpool diocese? And they said, yes, because anti-whiteness is actually anti-racism. And you're like, wow.
Whoa.
Like, really, really showing your true colours.
That's when you just think, that's not Christianity
anymore. No.
This is a new religion that's totally taken over the host and is now like a parasite on, the actual religion, because Christianity is for everyone and it should be completely inclusive. And everybody's equally loved by God. So it's just like, that's not Christianity. That's not,
I agree.
And to conflate Christianity with whiteness is hilarious, because I know people say Jesus was from Yorkshire. He wasn't.
No.
Yeah. And it's Middle Eastern.
Yeah. And in my Christian upbringing, I don't remember anyone ever talking about race. No one ever mentioned it as an issue or a thing or a... It just wasn't a thing.
Yeah. Well, in one of the reading materials they sent me, it said that Christianity is racist because it uses the words light and dark, and dark is related to sin and light's related to like spirituality, and that's racist. And it's like, well, firstly, those two words are used throughout literature and throughout all the religions. Like,
Diwali is a festival of lights.
Light. Exactly. And it's like, do you understand that the Bible was written like 2,000 years ago? And their whole conception of race was completely... Like, race doesn't even come up in the Bible.
No.
It's like they're not talking about skin colour at any point. Like, do you think that they're thinking, using words like light and dark in that way? Do you think it's more related to, like, night and daytime? But it's just this... It's just unbelievable ignorance. It's like, yeah.
And so being able to cope with speaking up and handling that backlash from that whole thing, did you have... any other kind of support from the people around you, or did they just go quiet and they gang up on you? Because I know that bullying was quite intense.
Yeah, bullying was quite bad. People that were very close to me were supportive, and my mum and family as well. And my whole kind of social group has changed significantly from going through that. But that's been a good thing.
Yeah.
So, initially, I think in the very early days of it, I felt very on my own, and it was incredibly stressful. And it wasn't until I was in the media and I started connecting with people that I didn't feel so mad. I was just like, oh, yeah, there's other people like me. And, you know, because when you're, when you've got a whole institution and people in a position of power telling you that, like, no, you're the wrong once and the wrong, it's really hard to, like, not let that in.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were about to go crazy?
Yeah. I was like, because you're like, unless you're really arrogant, you do have to sort of question, like, maybe I am doing something wrong. Like, if everybody's telling me I am, like, so it's really hard not to sort of feel like guilt and shame. Yeah. And they're really difficult emotions to deal with. And then it wasn't until I met people like who I really admire who were saying, no, you're doing the right thing. And then I sort of calmed down a little bit. But it was, it's really hard because you internalize it. You internalize what they're saying and you start feeling like, yeah, you must be doing something wrong. It's really horrible. It's a really kind of psychologically kind of abusive. I know that sounds extreme to say that, but it does feel like psychologically abusive. It's like, it's horrible. And I've never been through any kind of bullying before. And I was like, oh, I'm going through that thing that people talk about. I'm going through that kind of bullying, abusive thing. And I'm like, oh, this is horrible.
Really makes you empathize because I've been through similar. And I definitely had the whole, am I the bad guy?
Yeah.
Like really questioning your own beliefs and values. But it really, really makes you empathize with other people that have been through it. And there's more and more of us every day, you know, in whether it's in academia, in the workplace, you know, it's happening in secondary schools where kids are being told that they aren't allowed to think.
It's horrible.
And say certain things. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think once, if you are on the other end of something like this, even if it's not quite as bad as that you've experienced, once you go through that, every time you see somebody else go through it, even if you don't agree with what they've spoken up about, if you watch them getting ganged up on, you can't help but to feel a moral obligation to step forward and go, stop being so aggressive and give them just give them a chance to
you realize how awful it is. Because in some, like, before this happened, like, I was kind of listening to anti-woke podcasts and I was kind of in that space, like I was listening to trigonometry and other things like that, so I was kind of aware of what was going on and I knew about critical race theory. That's why I spoke up about it, because I understood how bad it was. I knew about cancel culture, so it wasn't like, I mean, I wasn't expecting them to be so aggressive as they was. I essentially said, you know, you're entitled to your views, but I'm entitled to mine. I thought it's really important to speak up and say there is a different way of thinking. I wasn't expecting they'd be so, you know, they'd turn on me so much. But even though I knew about cancel culture, and then when I was going for it, nothing can prepare you for it until you're in it. Because I thought, oh yeah, I could, you know, I could withstand that, I could speak up. But then when you're in it, it's just really, even though you know happening.
Why did I say that? Why didn't I just keep my mouth shut?
A bit of both. I was a bit like, oh, I don't know. Because then I was sort of thinking, I'm going to like lose my qualification. I'm not going to be able to do the profession that I've been working towards like for most of my adult life. But then I was sort of thinking, well, do I even want to be part of this profession if this is the direction it's going in? So like, you have to weigh up what you value, really.
And it takes so much courage and strength to be able to do what you did. And you wonder if there were no people, it's very rare to come across people like you who would in that situation speak up, knowing the risk to their career, personal life, everything else. Really rare to come across people that would actually do that in that situation. But you wonder how many people, or if there weren't people like you around, how quickly our country would go downhill. If there were nobody like, there weren't people like you to say, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense. Maybe let's just take a step back and think what we're actually pushing here. And if that's right.
Yeah.
And if that's what we want to be.
Because they just take it further and further.
Yeah.
I agree. I feel like the pushback here in the UK against the trans stuff, it's just been down to like a few individual lawsuits and people speaking up. And then you just think like, okay, we've got like J.K. Rowling, who's in a position of power because she's quite wealthy. And you just think, what if J.K. Rowling didn't exist? What if Mayor for Starter didn't exist?
Yeah.
The whole thing could be entirely different. So like, we're relying on a few individuals here to totally change the course of history.
Yeah, I know.
So it's like, that's mad.
Thank goodness the few do exist, though.
I know.
And think about, just if no one did, how quickly madness will escalate into power, like trans stuff. Because I imagine, I imagine all of this craziness, like trans stuff and critical race theory, all of these types of things, they've got so powerful because sort of, I just imagine boardrooms and conference meetings and everyone's just waiting for the little fish pie to come out and everyone just wants to have an enjoyable, agreeable time in important meetings. And then some radical pseudo-academic comes in and says, we should be doing this, we should be doing this. And if you're not, you're this label, you're this label, you're this label. And everyone like in this boardroom who are all dressed in their suits, they all go, okay, let's just get to lunch, let's get our fish pie, like, let's just go along with it, like, because I don't want to seem stupid when they're reading off Judith Butler, even though it doesn't make any sense. It sounds like it should make sense, and now I feel like an idiot because I don't understand it. I think that's the mentality, that's where I see all of this coming from. Just stupid, powerful people in boardrooms that just want to get to their lunch, and they've just gone,
Yeah, and they just want to stay comfortable, don't they? They don't want to take any risk or do any damage to their career. And it does annoy me because, like, I had to risk quite a lot. Like, I was just working as a nurse, like, I wasn't being paid a lot. And I'm looking at people who are in much more financially comfortable positions and, you know, have much more, better job or status than me. And they're not saying anything. I'm like, you could say something and you'd be okay. Like, I'm risking my ability to pay my mortgage, you know. So I do feel like, come on, guys, can more people speak up? But I do just think it is people make a calculation in their head of, like, you know, what the risk benefit analysis of, like, if I speak up, you know, it's just going to cause me hassle, and I don't want hassle. I just want to get my salary at the end of the month and have a quiet life. And that is the thing that most people come to, you know. But yeah, it's but I think the positive is that, like I said, it only takes a few individuals to kind of change things. So yeah, there is power in saying something.
Yeah, at least you've kind of been rewarded by this in the end. Well, you're not quite at the end yet, but you've kind of been just sort of like fast-tracked into like the public eye with this, and then you've just, I don't know, you're on a zip wire into like politics now, and
I know, it's been very strange. I could never have predicted what would have happened. It's amazing because, like, there were all these kind of organizations ready set up to support me, which is really brilliant. Like New Culture Forum really supported me, and like a lot of my crowdfunding for my legal case, a lot of the donations came in after I went on podcasts and started talking about it. And I do just think if that kind of environment wasn't there, like, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So I'm really grateful for the things that were created already that I could then, you know, get some support for. But it's
where can people donate to that?
Yeah, so I have a GoFundMe page, GoFundMe/StandUpToWoke, and I'm on Twitter at StandUpToWoke, and you can read about my legal case on my crowdfund. But yeah, it's been, I was quite a shy person before all this. And, you know, when I first started doing interviews, I was so nervous about being filmed and talking on camera. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience. I'm getting more used to it now.
But you're very good.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, people say that, but I feel awful. You know, it's very strange. But I always got very nervous beforehand. Yeah. And it was, you know, I was, But I'm getting used to it. But yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of really positive reaction and lots of people coming, you know, writing to me and saying thank you. So that's really good. And as you say, I'm now, you know, I'm a kind of a bit of a, I don't know, political commentator, or I don't know what you'll
call it.
Mayoral
candidate.
Mayoral candidate, yeah. So yeah, as you say, so I've been, I couldn't have even thought that. I've never been part of a political party before. And my whole stance was like, I just want to do my job as a nurse. I don't really want to be involved in politics. And that's kind of why I went into nursing. Because in my degree, it became very, like, I did a literature degree before I did nursing, and it was really political and it was all Marxism. And I was like, look, I just want to help people. I don't want all of this ridiculous nonsense. So that's why I went into nursing, because I enjoy caring for people. And I was like, just leave me alone with the ideology. Let me just get out there and connect with people. And nursing is being totally taken over by ideology. It's become like, it's really increasingly difficult to just do a job and not have all of this stuff be put onto you. There's some of us that just don't want to be political. We just want to do something we enjoy. So I decided, it's almost like, well, I have to be political in order to, like, push against this stuff. Like, they always going on about the culture wars, and it's like, no, I don't want a culture. I just want this stuff to stop.
Yeah.
I'd rather not go on about politics. But yeah, as you said, so I've been a member of the Social Democratic Party, which is a very small political party, for a while now. And yeah, I'm strangely, weirdly representing them in the London mayoral race, and we're running a campaign called Stand Up to Woke. So we want to push. We want to defund the diversity industry in London. Yes.
So that the elections are 1 week today, yes, as we're filming.
Yes.
So if someone is a voter and they don't like Sadiq Khan,
yes,
which, you know, that should be the majority by now.
You'd be surprised. But yeah. I know.
But why should they vote for you rather than Susan Hall?
It's a good question. I mean, I think a lot of people are frustrated with Labour and Tories. Tories have totally let us down in the last decade. Like, they've allowed all this woke stuff to take over. They've allowed mass immigration. I don't even think they're conservative. They're not even... all of their policies, to me, are like left-wing policies. They're basically the Labour Party. And I just think they make all these promises, but they don't mean them. And I don't know that Susan Hall would necessarily be any different. Like, she does talk about these issues a little bit, but she doesn't seem to get it. And she's not... I don't feel that she's tough enough. She's running a kind of anti-ULEZ campaign. That's her main thrust. And that, you know, I agree, I'm against ULEZ, but she doesn't really have a strong narrative. Like, Sadiq Khan's narrative is kind of diversity is our strength, you know, trans women are women. Mm. He buys into all the woke stuff. But I don't know what Susan Hall values or believes in. She's against ULEZ, but what is she, you know, going to do more broadly? So what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide an alternative. So we are saying we're actively going to push back. I want to promote neutrality across London transport and the police. I don't want to see the police taking a knee or getting involved in any kind of protest. They should just police. That's it. And all of these spaces should be neutral. So I'm kind of running on a kind of depoliticisation, neutrality kind of narrative, which, yeah, I mean... I think it's likely that Sadiq Khan will probably win, unfortunately. But if you vote SDP, you could help me get into the London Assembly, so I could take Sadiq Khan or the next mayor to task, because I don't think Sadiq Khan or Susan Hall are going to be that much good. I mean, to be honest, I think mass immigration is the thing that's mostly affecting London, and the mayor doesn't really have any power over that anyway. There's all sorts of complicated issues. But I feel like just totally defunding all the woke stuff could be a step in the right direction. So that's what I'm running
agree.
On.
If Sadiq Khan does continue, what do you think is going to come next with him? Things like paper mile,
yeah, just more and more infringement on people's freedoms. There's like this absolute war on cars, and I see that as, to me, the car is like the symbol of freedom. It's like your independence to go somewhere. And for many people, like, I don't drive, but during lockdown I was like, I really wish I'd learned to drive, because it was such a important thing to be able to go out and drive somewhere and not to be kind of told to wear a mask and to do your own thing. And I think it's just a crackdown on people's independence.
Yeah.
It's just like so authoritative.
Do you know, I think people don't realise, for Brits, our cars are what guns are to Americans.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's like your bit where you can feel like you're an individual, and you're like, it's like a little mini home. Like, I can go somewhere and I can not have the state interfere, and I can do what I want in my car. And... yeah, I just think it doesn't surprise me that Sadiq Khan is attacking cars, because, yeah, it's freedom, isn't it? That's what it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think he'll just push the woke stuff more and more. Like, he's recently changed all the names of train lines to, like, the Suffragette line and the Windrush line. It's just ridiculous. It's like, oh, I'm going to jump on the Suffragette.
It was really needed.
Like, what? Like, £6 million that's cost. And you just think, what a waste of money. And can we just not... I just want to not have a message put onto me. I just want to get on a train and not have to sort of think, oh, you know, mm-hmm. it's some kind of thing that I have to sort of think about. I don't want that. So it's just going to be more wokery, more trans women or women, as he often tweets out, more infringement on people's freedoms. And yeah, unfortunately, it's just going to get worse.
I find it really interesting that he says all of that stuff, because every time I get in an Uber and there's a Muslim driver, what I will talk to him about is LGBT stuff. And my...
None of you.
I know.
So brave.
And I say...
I've never done that.
Mine never speak to me. They're always on the phone.
But I say, I'm a TERF and I campaign against the Gender Recognition Act and to reform the Equalities Act, and they go nuts for it because they can't stand the trans stuff and the LGBT stuff. So I don't know what Muslims really think about Sadiq Khan. I'd be interested to really get into what they think about Sadiq.
I think a lot of them think he's like a fake Muslim, or he's just like, he identifies as a Muslim.
You're probably right.
A liberal Muslim, I think, really.
Yeah, a liberal Muslim who just wears it as an identity. But as you say, he weighs the trans flag, he weighs the pride flag, he gets involved in all of that stuff. You know, his Twitter feed is more it's more woke than it is Islamic. Like, he's pushing that ideology more than he is pushing any kind of, you know, Islamic ideals. I think he's... I think a lot of Muslims are dissatisfied with him, but, you know, he just still gets all these votes. I think he just gets votes because he's Labour. It's just tribalism.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people just vote for him because, oh, it's Labour, mm-hmm. and we don't like Tories. And that's the nature of our politics at the moment, unfortunately. Yeah.
And very much with the Red Wall.
Yeah.
The SDP
is
having a really important role to play in Red Wall areas.
Yeah.
It's like a target audience, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's so important that there's some other force out there that isn't Conservative and isn't Labour.
Yeah.
And is going to fill the role that Labour is really meant to be there for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, in the Red Wall, that, you know, they don't like Tories very much, or they feel very let down. They sort of lended Boris their vote, didn't they? Because they're naturally kind of economically left-leaning. But they're sick and tired of mass immigration and woke, so they, you know, voted Conservative, held their nose and voted Conservative. What the SDP offer, and even though we're a very small party, many people know about us, but we do offer something, I think, for the Red Wall, is that we are, you know, economically kind of centre-left, and we're not kind of really Thatcherite. But we are culturally conservative, and that does fit with a lot of those northern votes. We've got some councillors in Leeds now, and we're growing, and more and more people are sort of thinking, yeah, that kind of suits me. So it's just going to take a bit of time, I think. I think, you know, this year that Labour are probably going to get in power, and I think it's going to be a really rough ride after that. And I'm hoping that at some point people will just start to look to the smaller parties. They're doing that with Reform already, like Reform are building. But I would love to see the two main parties be Reform and the SDP.
I'd love that.
Because Reform are a much better Conservative party than the Conservative. And SDP are much better sort of left-leaning party than Labour. They're like really good versions of left and right.
Yeah.
And it's like they have... But
that's very true. Yeah. I didn't think of it like that. But yeah, and obviously for really effective politics and a really efficient, effective, honest parliament, you need great opposition.
Yeah, I agree.
So... to have those parties,
there's virtues and points in both the left and the right. Like, you want a balance, really. Like, I'd probably tend to lean more Conservative on most issues, but like you say, I'd want a really good left-leaning party to hold people to account, and like, they've both got good points, and I think most of us just want to like solve problems. Like, it not to be about ideology, but like, what's the best solution to this particular problem? Like, can our politics not just try to like work things out and, you know, do it rather than kind of political point scoring? So yeah, that would be amazing if we could have a really good conservative party and a really good left-leaning party, because I just feel like Labour and Tory are just the worst of everything. They're not I don't think they're getting anything done. Nothing's being done in good faith.
Yeah,
they're not trying to work together. it's all about propaganda, and it is just, it's awful. Yeah.
One thing that's really been affecting Londoners for the past almost 6 months, no longer than 6 months, since October 7th, is these pro-Palestine protests, which often have a lot of extremism, violence, what was it, fireworks shot at police horses. So if you were mayor, would you put some restrictions on these protests or ban them or just allow them to carry on?
It's a difficult one. I definitely put restrictions on them. I mean, what I would want to do with the police force is, well, defund all the woke stuff, but I'd want to bring in training in neutrality and for the police to have a better understanding of the law, because we've seen extreme kind of two-tier policing in that the police are just allowing things that are clearly extremist and clearly going against the Public Order Act within the pro-Palestinian marches. And yet they're then like getting on horses and charging into like three blokes waving an England flag. And you're like, but what were they doing? They're just standing there. And you're seeing people jumping on top of monuments, graffitiing things with the pro-Palestinian march. And they're just like, I don't know if it's that they're probably, there's a combination of things. I think it's just they're scared, the sheer mass of people in the pro-Palestinian march. It's like the pro-Israel and the kind of England, St. George's Day marches are a lot smaller. They're probably scared of being called racist. And I just don't think they have a good knowledge of the law or what they don't. I don't think they know what to do. I just think they're looking really unprofessional at the moment. So I'd really want to just professionalise them. In terms of the pro-Palestinian marches, there's some that were so extreme. Like I was sort of thinking, do you want to get the army? If the police can't handle it and they don't have the manpower, then at what point do we bring the army in? Because like this is scary. Like Jews don't feel safe. It's like London's becoming like a no-go zone for Jews. And that like breaks my heart because our whole cult, like we fought the Nazis, like we gave up so many lives to defend freedom and fight fascism. And then you're seeing like people waving a swastika and like making openly anti-Semitic statements. Like I had someone during the height of the pro-Palestinian marches, I was just like topping up my oyster and someone came up to me and said, are you a Jew? And I said, excuse me, like that, I don't want to say what my ethnicity is. Are you a Jew? And I said, I don't want to answer. And then she just shouted pro-Palestine in my face. And I was so scared. I was like really shaken by it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not Jewish, but I just thought.
Imagine if you were.
Like I was shaken by it. And I'm quite tough. But I thought, I was just left with this horrible feeling. And I just sort of thought, oh, that's so horrible. And like, I just thought, I don't want to be in London anymore. It's just like, this is not what I grew up in. This is not the values that I thought London was about. I thought London was about like British values of tolerance and like decency and freedom and, you know, anti-fascism. So yeah, I would definitely be a lot more stronger on the pro-Palestine marches, and I would want to be seeing people being arrested and, you know, yeah. So, yeah.
It's a hard one because you want to be accommodating protest, and free speech, but you don't. There's some things you need to draw the line at.
Yeah, I know it's a hard balance, and it's something that I think about a lot actually, because I am pro free speech and pro freedom and people's right to protest. But at what point does it become something else? Like, I don't know how to name these pro-Palestinian marches. To me, it's more than a protest. It's morphed into something else that's intimidating and frightening. And it's really interesting. It's been making me think a lot about free speech issues and where do you draw the line. I don't fully have the answer yet. I'm trying to think it through.
Because personally, I was always challenging myself to push myself more on sort of free speech of like freedom, almost close to absolutist as I can possibly be. But this whole thing has made me really reconsider all of that. And if I even want to support that much freedom of speech anymore. Personally.
Yeah. And I think what's scary is that the institutions, particularly the police, are sort of on side, or they feel like they are. And that's where, to me, it becomes something else, because they should be policing it, you know, and looking for any kind of antisocial behaviour that would be breaching the law, but they're not. And then you think, well, this is going beyond just freedom of speech. This feels like a kind of institutional, I don't know, capture or something going on. But yeah, it is making me question things like about liberalism and tolerance, and at what point do you say, hang on, we've got to stop this, because it's the slippery slide, right? Like, this is how, I don't want to sound like hyperbolic, but this is how things like Nazi Germany happened.
Yeah.
When people notice things that they're not quite comfortable with, and then they allow it and it gets bigger and more powerful, it doesn't happen overnight. So at what point do you intervene and restrict people's freedoms to stop something that's so dangerous from happening? I don't fully know.
Because liberalism will have a certain lifespan, because it's naturally embracing to all sorts.
Yeah.
And you can kind of have so much freedom that it's a vulnerable state to be in, because if we're all kind of accommodating each other and letting each other have differences and things like that, it's a kind of vulnerability, and you have a certain weakness with that a strong ideology will come along, and then that, like, the strength of that will overpower. So you've got to kind of have to ensure longevity for a liberal democracy, time will run out, and then you have to become quite strict with certain policies about what you're going to allow and what you're not, and you have to cut back your freedom of speech to a certain amount.
I agree. I think we've been a bit naive about liberalism and what it can withstand. Like, I think we believe in our values so much that we think they're just brilliant and they can withstand anything, and of course everybody would want to be a part of those values, but it seems like people don't. And what do you do with that? It's like if you're playing a game and you invite someone in to play the game, and then the person that's invited in just kind of like throws the board and says like, yeah, I'm not going to do any of the rules of your game. It's like, well, then you can't be part of the game then.
Yeah.
Like, how do you like work out who you can bring into the game?
That's such a good analogy.
Yeah, it's just like, you can't have a sort of, anybody can enter into this thing if they're going to like destroy the thing.
Yeah.
Because then you lose then nobody can play the game.
No, yeah, and then our liberal freedom and democracy won't exist anymore.
And then it's gone.
Catherine Birbal-Singh has probably been the most successful person in having a multicultural community in that school. But that has, you know, freedoms have had to be curtailed for that to work and for there to be peace and cohesiveness. I think that's
good, because example.
You know, after after COVID lockdowns, I was so pro freedom. I was like, because we'd been literally controlled by the government for 2 years, in some ways longer, that I suddenly became so pro freedom. But then that was when I lived in my lovely peaceful village in County Durham, and then coming down to the South, where there is so much more multiculturalism, I realized you can't have that when people don't have the shared culture and the shared goal, and a lot of people actually prioritize their home country over, you know, having a functioning, successful society in the country that they've emigrated to.
I think the Catherine Birbal-Singh kind of microcosm is really interesting, because she seemingly has found a way of different cultures being able to coexist, although she's still having issues. You know, it's not like it's been a complete plain sailing. She's just, you know, had a lawsuit against her. But the sacrifices that school has had to make in order to get that cohesion, like, they all have to eat vegetarian food. It's like, well, what if you don't want to eat vegetarian food? Like, what if you want to eat meat? And it's like, oh, that's the only way we can all have a kind of shared value system, and that we all have to like sing the national anthem, and we all have to like, we can't talk in corridors, and that she is very, you know, it's quite strict, and I'm not against strictness, but you do realize that real sacrifices have to be made in order for cultures to be able to just get along smoothly. And you're like, but do we really want that? Like, I don't know. Like, we were never asked on any of this, you know. And do we want to sacrifice things, you know, thing like our freedoms in order to get along? Like, I don't know that we do. And like, if you imagine like Catherine Birbal-Singh's school being like the way that the country would run in order for us to all different cultures to get along, we'd have to give up lots of like I said, our freedoms, like, oh, we have to all eat the same, we have to all kind of, you know, and it just, you just think, but I don't think, maybe it's too much to ask of a country and of a culture that we all give up things in order to get along. I don't know. It's difficult, but yeah, I think
that's where a lot of people's heads are at the moment.
To prolong the, our Britain that we love and know.
Yeah.
I think discipline, strengthening, and integrity need to come back into fashion.
Definitely.
Because integrity just isn't rated anymore.
No, I know.
And then we're so undisciplined in our day-to-day lives.
Completely.
We're so fat and lazy and it's just like we're lacking that discipline.
Yeah. All our structures have disappeared.
Structures, yeah. And our kind of military mindset.
I know.
It's all gone away, and our personal responsibility to strengthen ourselves and our spirituality and our bodies, and there's something to be said for that discipline, strength and integrity, and I think about those things a lot, and we're missing those desperately.
I wonder if it's just because they're not rewarded, like there's no incentive in our society to have integrity, like what do you get? You just get cancelled.
Well, exactly, you know. Get what you had.
Yeah, exactly, like what you know, it's not rewarded, and we're rewarding the wrong things.
Yeah,
like, so all our incentive structures are wrong. Like, you can get better, you know, if you go off work for sickness, like you can get long-term benefits, like there's no incentive to work, there's no incentive like to tell the truth, you just get bullied. Like, all the wrong things are being given attention and reward, even in our media. Like, if you go on the channel on like media and you say really outrageous stupid things, you'll get lots of clicks and likes, and you know, you'll probably be asked on again because you get lots of views. But there's no like incentive to be like nuanced or balanced, because nobody's interested in that. And it's just, I don't know. It's really hard. It does feel at some level like spiritual, because you do think, like, I don't even think politics can even help with some of the things we're facing. And that sounds a bit demoralizing, but I don't know. There needs to be like a whole consciousness shift. Like,
yeah, I think more about on the ground roots level, sort of the social before the political. Like, the social is like our foundations. So I would try and hold my feet to this by thinking, if I am patriotic, I'm going to pick up that litter, even though that's not mine.
Yeah.
And if everyone just did that a little bit more, I think great things would come down the line from that. If we all started just do those small things that just went, I love my country, I love the people around me, I want everyone to be the best they can be, I'm gonna make this a nice environment, I'm gonna pick up this, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna help this person out down the road, or something like that, that's just sort of really grassroots.
But we all need to be servants to our country, really.
Yeah.
And the late Queen really was the great example of that.
She was amazing. I miss the Queen. I think you're right. I think you, and also when you do that, you feel better about yourself. Like, you, the world opens up to you when you start to live your values. Especially when even the small things, like on your day to day, when you're not being watched, and like you do the right thing, like you see yourself differently, like you become more confident, and you benefit. It's a healthy way to live, and it's not something you can cheat on. Like, there's no shortcuts to kind of having that strong sense of self where you can look people in the eye and say, yeah, I live by my values. You can't fake it. So you may as well just do it, because it benefits you and it benefits everyone. So it feels like a no-brainer to just, you know, live out what you believe in. And that's how I think.
So we've now come to the end of the free part of this episode of Bombshells. But if you would like to watch the full premium version, where we're going to ask Amy about immigration, the Equality Act and water cannons, then go to basedmedia.org and subscribe for as little as £5 a month. Thank you.
So, Amy, who would you use water cannons on?